Thank you to those who took part in the special music. That's a very moving piece and a very specially appropriate one on this day. Before I start, just briefly, I had handed to me what appears to be a little charm that's in the shape of a crown someone found in the building. So if that's yours, come and see me, but wait until after the sermon. That's not a good excuse to get up off your chair and take a break. I have a question for you today. Is there a connection from one holy day to the next in God's plan? Now, most of us would say, where have you been that you don't know the answer to that question? That would be bad. The fact that you know the answer is yes, that would be good. And I promise to stop with that right now. That would be good. Oh, wait a minute. You know, when you've been around someone for a long time, you begin to pick up little habits, little quirks, but I was highly insulted at lunch hour when someone said to me they thought that Mr. Myers and I looked like we could be twins. But when they called me Dave, that was the problem. No. Good friends go back a long way. Let me read you something from yesterday's Cleveland Plain Dealer. The article was taken from another newspaper, the Washington Post, reprinted by permission. The subject was the approach of what is often called the Jewish New Year. And as you heard Mr. Myers explain this morning, it doesn't have anything to do with trumpets. The Hebrew phrase means the head of the year or the beginning of the year. It's a reference to the fact that they believe it is, in fact, the beginning of the calendar year, even though it's the seventh month. After giving the basics in this article about the Jewish observance of this festival, which Jews often extend by one day to make it a two-day observance, clearly that's an adjustment that God's Word says nothing about. The article went on to quote a woman who is a rabbi at a Washington, D.C. synagogue. And she stated that these holidays, that was her term, or at least that was the paper's term, mark more than just a clean start to the year for observant Jews. She said, "This is an opportunity for us to say, who am I today?" She said, "What happened to me? And what did I do that brought me to this moment? And is this who I want to be?" That was the way she explained the meaning of Rosh Hashanah. Regarding the Day of Atonement, which observant Jews believe completes the High Holy Days, or the 10 Days of Awe, as they're sometimes referred to, the same lady rabbi stated this: "That's a day to be our truest version of ourselves, to make connections with others, to make our apologies and to hold to them, and to think about the change we want to be in the world." Did you notice anything missing? That would be bad. Really, is the meaning of the Day of Atonement all about human beings only? Well, if you noticed anything missing, you're in a good group, because I would say we'd notice just about everything missing. And that would be bad. For trumpets, where is the realization that this day pictures the return of Jesus Christ in power and glory to the Mount of Olives, the place where about eight of us in here stood 3 months and a half ago, and looked around us and looked across the Kidron Valley at the Dome of the Rock glistening in the sun and realized what it meant to stand there? What about the resurrection of the saints? We've heard about that a lot today, about meeting Jesus Christ in the air and descending to the Mount of Olives, which will then split in two to make a pathway for those healing waters to travel. Now, of course, if your belief system holds that the Messiah has not yet come, it's a bit hard to speak of his return. And then there's the missing aspect, as I said, the resurrection of the saints, and the fact that it is a day of war, the prophecy of Joel 2, the defeat by force of the rebellious resistance to Jesus Christ's appearance. Not happily carried out, as we heard this morning in the sermonette, at all, but of necessity because of the corruption caused by the archenemy of God, and then the next holy day deals with him. For atonement, in the words that I read to you, where is the marvelous explanation of what the banishment of Satan will mean for the human race? Of how all humans can be given the opportunity to enter into a covenant relationship with their Father, unencumbered by a subtle but persistent force that pushes humans to the bad fruit side of what is essentially the wrong tree in the first place. Now, that's not to find fault with any human being or with any constructed system of belief. And I chose that phrase on purpose, a constructed system of belief. What we have, brethren, is a revealed system of belief. There's a big difference. After all, you and I, of all people, should appreciate the astonishing power of a very familiar verse, John 6, verse 44. No one can come to me unless the Father who sent me draws him, and I will raise him up at the last day. Basically repeated in verse 65, same chapter, therefore I have said to you that no one can come to me unless it has been granted to him by my Father. You and I, of all people, should realize how important that verse is, what it means for the future of all mankind. Now, where does that verse and its meaning put us on the afternoon of this very special day on God's calendar? To try to begin to answer that, I want to quote a much more reliable source than any human teacher or leader, no matter how well-meaning they could ever be. So let's take a look. I would like to read another familiar verse. It's from Mark chapter 1, a couple of verses, Mark 1, but I'm going to read it from a seldom used translation. And when I give you the name of it, you'll understand. It's hard to pronounce it, so you don't want to go ahead and use it if you can't pronounce it. It's called the emphatic diaglot of the New Testament with interlinearary word-for-word English translation. Did you get that? There will be a test after the sermon, and you will have to stay seated in those hard chairs until you get it right. No. Okay, that's a mouthful. What it basically means is that this translation starts with the commonly accepted Greek text of the New Testament, understanding, as I'm sure we should, that there are no original texts available to us today. No original texts exist. We do not have any parchments that Paul wrote on, or that Matthew or Mark or Luke or John actually wrote on. We have copies that have been preserved over the centuries. But there have been enough discoveries over the years, especially of the Old Testament, the Dead Sea Scrolls, to prove the accuracy of the copying. The passage is Mark 1, verses 14 and 15. I will read it from the Diaglot. There's a little shortened version. Now, after John was imprisoned, Jesus came into Galilee, publishing the glad tidings of God, and saying, "The time has been accomplished, and God's royal majesty has approached. Reform and believe in the good message." That's a word-for-word translation from the original Greek, adjusting it to make sense in English because languages put together their thoughts and phrases in sentences in different ways. But that's basically a word-for-word translation. In some ways, it helps. it helps to clear up any confusion from that familiar translation, the kingdom of God is at hand. Well, we always kind of struggle with that. Well, what does that mean? Obviously, we're 2,000 years later and the kingdom of God still isn't here. Well, there's the ruler of the kingdom. And that's exactly what it stresses. The time has been accomplished. It was time for the Messiah to appear. And God's royal majesty has approached. And that is precisely what happened back then. But what was the point? What was he telling people, in effect, that they needed to do? Well, it was in the last part of that message, reform and believe in the good message, or we're more familiar, repent and believe in the gospel. Do you and I do that today on the Feast of Trumpets? The day that also could be described as the time has been accomplished and God's royal majesty has approached, or we might say in the meaning of the day, will be approaching. How long have you been keeping this day? I wonder if we were to go around the room, I won't do this, but to add up how many Feasts of Trumpets the 210 of us who are here today represent. Multiple thousands, I am sure. This is number 60 for me, my 60th Feast of Trumpets. And still, he hasn't come back yet. He's still not here. Back then, if you had asked me as a young boy if I would ever keep 60 Feasts of Trumpets, I would have, not in this life. Do you ever cry out to God and ask, how long, eternal? How long? I think we all must at some point. Ezekiel had something to say about that in Ezekiel chapter 9. Ezekiel chapter 9. In verse 3, it says, now the glory of the God of Israel had gone up from the cherub where it had been to the threshold of the temple. And he called to the man clothed with linen who had the writer's inkhorn at his side. This was an angel. And the Eternal said to him, go through the midst of the city, through the midst of Jerusalem, and put a mark on the foreheads of the men who sigh and cry over all the abominations that are done within it. Brethren, are you and I part of that number? Would the man with the writer's inkhorn be stopping and putting a mark on your forehead and mine? I certainly hope so. Those who sigh and cry for all the abominations, who ache for the time when the meaning of this day can be fulfilled, not the flame and the smoke and the death and the war and the awful fears and smells of a world being corrupted and destroying itself. Not that, but for the sign in the heavens of the Son of Man returning to this earth. Let's dig a little deeper today to see what the message is. What would the royal majesty want us to know about the day that pictures his approach? What would he want us to be aware of as the day of his return approaches closer and closer? No, he hasn't come back yet, but I can say very confidently one thing. He is closer than he was in the year 1960 when I kept trumpets number one 59 years ago. How about we start with some of the parables he taught that had overtones of his return? Turn to Matthew chapter 13. You're familiar with it, this one. Verse 3, he spoke many things to them in parables, saying, behold, a sower went out to sow. And as he sowed, some seed fell by the wayside. The birds came and devoured them. Some fell on stony places where they didn't have much earth. They immediately sprang up because they had no depth of earth. But when the sun was up, they were scorched, and because they had no root, they withered away. Some fell among thorns, and the thorns sprang up and choked them. But others fell on good ground and yielded a crop, some 100-fold, some 60, some 30. He who has ears to hear, let him hear. So the disciples said, "Why do you speak to them in parables?" He answered and said, "Because it's been given to you to know the mysteries of the kingdom of heaven, but to them it's not been given. Whoever has, to him more will be given, he'll have abundance. Whoever doesn't have, even what he has will be taken away from him. So I speak to them in parables, because seeing they don't see, hearing they don't hear, nor do they understand." He goes on to quote Isaiah. But verse 16 is interesting. He says, "Blessed are your eyes, for they see, and your ears, for they hear. For assuredly I say to you that many prophets and righteous men desired to see what you see and did not see it, and hear what you hear and didn't hear it. Therefore hear the parable of the sower. When anyone hears the word of the kingdom and does not understand it, the wicked one comes and snatches away what was sown in his heart. This is he who received seed by the wayside. He who received the seed on stony places, this is he who hears the word and immediately receives it with joy. Yet he has no root in himself, but endures only for a while. For when tribulation or persecution arises because of the word, immediately he stumbles. Now he who received seed among the thorns is the one who hears the word, and the cares of this world and the deceitfulness of riches choke the word, and he becomes unfruitful. But he who received seed on the good ground is he who hears the word and understands it, who bears fruit and produces, some 100-fold, some 60, some 30. We have probably, all of us, read this parable scores of times, maybe hundreds. What might we have missed? Let's look at it a little bit more closely. What's the central point? Well, it's in verses 9, 11, and 16. Do you see it? He who has ears to hear, let him hear. Verse 11, it has been given to you to know the mysteries of the kingdom. And verse 16, blessed are your eyes, for they see, and your ears, for they hear. That's the key point, brethren. You and I get it. And that's good. The world does not yet, and that's bad for now, but it will change in God's own time. Does that remind you of anything we started with today, like John 6 and verse 44? Have you ever considered that maybe that verse is at the core of the Feast of Trumpets? Remember the explanation I read from the newspaper article at the beginning of what they refer to as Rosh Hashanah, the head of the year, the start of the year. Was there much understanding there? Virtually none. Now, is it a bad thing to ask, who am I today? What happened to me and what did I do that brought me to this moment? And is this who I want to be? Is that bad to ask those questions? Well, no. But it has nothing to do with the meaning of this day. And that's the important part. God gives the understanding of his holy days to help us see what he's doing. My wife and I had an interesting conversation just last week with a lady who made reference to when she understood that I was a pastor. They always follow up, what is the church? They tell them, and I explain it's a small Sabbatarian group. We keep the seventh-day Sabbath. She said, "Oh, well, that's the way it was in the very beginning." And I said, "That's right." She said, "Yeah, the Emperor Constantine." I should have let her explain. She said, "He changed it." I said, "Yes, he did." I said, "If it helps you to see where we're coming from," I said, "we consider ourselves first century Christians, not fourth century Christians." She said, "I see. I get it." And I made a comment then about, and after we get back home, we do have another trip coming up. We're going to the Feast of Tabernacles. She was nodding. "Yes, I understand." But then she talked about her group that did not keep the Sabbath and what she was doing and so on. Blessed are your eyes, for they see, and your ears, for they hear. Who gave you the knowledge you have? And please don't say, "Well, I figured it out all on my own." It is a revealed system of belief that you and I are part of, not constructed. Look at the categories of this familiar parable and what they mean. Seed by the wayside, eaten by birds. What's the meaning? People who hear and don't understand. And even if they think it's of some value and try to hang on to it for a minute, it doesn't last. It's snatched away. Seed on stony places is scorched by the sun. The roots are too shallow. It means there are people who joyfully hear the message, but they have no root. They have no resistance against tests and trials. Seed among thorns means that the truth is choked out by the cares of the world, by the riches and so on. Seed on good ground, someone who hears, understands, bears fruit, and produces. Where do we fit on that list? Is there a meaning to glean, if you'll pardon the pun for the parable of the sower, from this parable? What are we doing with the knowledge we've been blessed with? And what does it have to do with the meaning of this day? Turn to Matthew 25, another familiar parable, the parable of the talents. If you want a title for this sermon, I guess you could call it the Feast of Trumpets in Parables. For you mathematical types, you could rename that to the Parabolic Feast of Trumpets. Matthew 25, verse 14, the kingdom of heaven is like a man traveling to a far country who called his servants and delivered his goods to them. To one he gave 5 talents, to another 2, to another 1, to each according to his own ability. And immediately he went on a journey. He who had received the 5 talents went and traded with them and made 5 other talents. Likewise, he who had received 2 gained 2 more. He who had received the 1 went and dug in the ground and hid his Lord's money. After a long time, the Lord of those servants came and settled accounts with them. So he who had received the 5 came and brought 5 more and said, Lord, you delivered to me 5. I have gained 5 more besides those. His Lord said, well done, good and faithful servant. You were faithful over a few things. I will make you ruler over many things. Enter into the joy of your Lord. My wife and I were in Meadville this past week for services, but I understand that one of the split sermons by Mr. Matt Pavlik was being faithful in little. He also who had received 2 talents came and said, Lord, you delivered to me 2 talents. Look, I've gained 2 more besides them. Same percentage increase. He doubled what he had. The Lord said to him, well done, good and faithful servant. You've been faithful over a few things. I will make you ruler over many things. Enter into the joy of your Lord. Identical wording. Then the one who'd received 1 said, Lord, I knew you to be a hard man. We might say, well, I knew, you know, I understood you to be a hard man. Reaping where you haven't sown, gathering where you haven't scattered seed. In other words, you don't make sense to me. I don't understand how you're working. And I was afraid because I didn't understand, and I hid your talent in the ground. So look, take it back. Here's yours. Get it away from me. His Lord said, you wicked and lazy servant, you knew that I reaped where I hadn't sown and gathered where I hadn't scattered seed, or you thought you knew, or that was your impression. So you should have taken my money to the bankers, and at my coming I would at least have received my own with interest. Take the talent from the one who had it and give it to the one who has 10. To everyone who has, more will be given. He'll have abundance. From him who doesn't have, even what he has will be taken away, and cast the unprofitable servant into the outer darkness. There will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. 2 different reactions. Regret over a missed opportunity and rebellion to the end. What's the central point? Verses 21 and 23. Joyful and encouraging, his Lord said, well done, good and faithful servant. You've been faithful over a few things. I'll make you ruler over many things. Enter into the joy of your Lord. That connects to the Feast of Trumpets, the resurrection of the saints, the ones to whom he will say, well done, all of you. Now we have work to do. What's the danger with the approach of the one talent man? Verses 25 and 29, do we approach this time foretold by the Feast of Trumpets with confidence, forceful action, and joyful anticipation, or fear and misunderstanding? We could do either. If you understand the prophecies, you could do either one. But you and I don't tend to focus on the difficulties ahead, and I think that's right and proper. Yes, it's going to be a troubled time. We're told in the prophecies that it will be the worst that this old earth has ever seen, and that's rather hard to comprehend when you know what has happened in the past. But at the end of it, what lies ahead? Go back to the early part of chapter 25, to the parable of the 10 virgins. The kingdom of heaven shall be likened to 10 virgins who took their lamps and went out to meet the bridegroom, and 5 were wise and 5 were foolish. Those who were foolish took their lamps and took no oil with them. But the wise took oil in their vessels with their lamps, and while the bridegroom was delayed, they all slumbered and slept. Please note that. At midnight, a cry was heard, "Behold, the bridegroom is coming. Go out to meet him." They all arose to trim their lamps, and the foolish said to the wise, "Give us some of your oil, for our lamps are going out." But the wise said, "No, lest there should not be enough for us and you, but you go to those who sell and buy for yourselves." You and I, brethren, cannot build spiritual character in another human being. That's the analogy here. It's not that the wise were being selfish and saying, "Not a chance, you know, slap the hand away from my oil cruise." That's not the point. We're talking about an analogy. While they went to buy, the bridegroom came, and those who were ready went in with him to the wedding, and the door was shut. When the trial arrives, it will be a little too late to build the character you need to go through that trial. We know the way this one turns out. The point, verses 5 and 13. While the bridegroom was delayed, they all slumbered and slept. We all, brethren, have faults and weaknesses, and we all stumble from time to time. What's important is to not stay down, to get back up and keep moving toward God's kingdom. Do we get up again and keep on this path in a watchful and yielded way? Verse 13 says, "Watch, therefore, you don't know. You know neither the day nor the hour in which the Son of Man is coming." We presume that it may very well be on the Feast of Trumpets some year because it symbolizes his return. But if he decides he doesn't want to return on this precise day, are we going to argue with him? No, get back up into heaven. It's the wrong time. I'm not ready yet. Look at those who weren't ready and what happened. It doesn't work that way. Now, this one is connected to Matthew 24, verses 44 to 51, the parable that talks about people not knowing. "Therefore, you be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour you don't expect. Who is a faithful and wise steward?" The parable of the wise steward. "Whom his master made ruler over his household to give them food in due season. Blessed is that servant whom his master, when he comes, will find so doing." Is that because he has spies posted watching for Jesus Christ's arrival? And he gets busy because Jesus is coming. You know, look busy because Jesus is coming. No, that's not the issue. The issue is you are ready, and it doesn't matter when he comes. And of course, brethren, which of us has a rock-solid guarantee that we will live until that time? Which of us has a rock-solid guarantee we will live until whatever time? This mortal life means it's temporary, it's mortal. "Assuredly, I say to you that he will make him ruler over all his goods. But if that evil servant says in his heart, 'My master is delaying his coming,' and he begins to beat his fellow servants and eat and drink with the drunkards, his master will come on a day when he's not looking for him, and in an hour that he's not aware of." My point is, why do you have to look? What difference does it make whether you're aware? "And he'll cut him in two and appoint him his portion with the hypocrites. There'll be weeping and gnashing of teeth." Stay focused is the message. Don't allow the world's distractions to sidetrack us. Keep looking to the plan God has for us. Keep obeying him. What would he want us to do? Let's go back to Ezekiel for a moment to see how that prophet described how he understood what God was looking for. Ezekiel 22, this time, And in the midst of a corrupt society, these words came to Ezekiel, verse 23 of Ezekiel 22. The word of the Eternal came to me, saying, Son of man, say to her, you are a land that is not cleansed or rained on in the day of indignation. The conspiracy of her prophets in her midst is like a roaring lion tearing the prey. They've devoured people. They've taken treasure and precious things. They have made many widows in her midst. Her priests have violated my law and profaned my holy things. They have not distinguished between the holy and the unholy, nor have they made known the difference between the clean and the unclean. They've hidden their eyes from my Sabbaths, so that I am profaned among them. Her princes in her midst are like wolves tearing the prey to shed blood, to destroy people, to get dishonest gain. Her prophets plastered them with untempered mortar. A cover-up doesn't actually change the problem underneath. Seeing false visions, divining lies for them, saying, Thus says the Lord Eternal, when the Eternal hadn't spoken. The people of the land have used oppressions, they've committed robbery, they've mistreated the poor and the needy, and they wrongfully oppress the stranger. So I sought for a man among them who would make a wall and stand in the gap before me on behalf of the land, that I should not destroy it, but I found no one. Therefore, I have poured out my indignation on them. I have consumed them with the fire of my wrath. I have recompensed their deeds on their own heads, says the Lord God. Verses 23 to 29 and verse 31 describe a society that looks frighteningly like our own. Verse 30 describes what God is looking for in his people. He says, So I sought. What kind of person is he searching for? Someone who would build a wall and who would stand in the gap. Brethren, are you willing to stand in the gap for this priceless calling we've been given? For the amazing meaning of this holy day, to say, I will not let it go. I believe with God's help we can do that. There are some things we need to remember along the way, because one day he will return. It didn't happen today. There are prophecies that indicate there are sequences of events that must come to pass first. But someday it will happen. There will come a day, as I've said in numerous sermons, there will come a day that the sun will come up that morning. And before it sets that night, Jesus Christ will have returned to this earth. It will be a literal day in the history of mankind. And since the sun set in Jerusalem several hours ago, I think we can rule out today. Matthew 18 has the parable of the debtors. Matthew 18, verse 23. Therefore, the kingdom of heaven is like a certain king who wanted to settle accounts with his servants. And when he had begun to settle accounts, one was brought to him who owed him 10,000 talents. As he was not able to pay, his master commanded that he be sold with his wife and children and all that he had, and payment be made. The servant fell down before him and said, Master, have patience with me, and I'll pay you all. Then the master of that servant was moved with compassion, released him, and forgave the debt. But the servant went out and found one of his fellow servants who owed him 100 Roman pennies. And he laid hands on him and took him by the throat and said, Pay me what you owe me. His fellow servant fell down at his feet and begged him, saying, Have patience with me, and I'll pay you all. Does that ring a bell? Does that sound familiar at all? And he would not, but he went and threw him into prison till he should pay the debt. I always wondered about that myself growing up as a kid. I thought, what's the deal with debtor's prison? Well, the answer was not the person in the prison, but his friends and relatives were supposed to bail him out and pay the debt. course, if you didn't have any friends and your relatives didn't like you, you might be in there a long time. Message is, if you're going to owe money, you better be a likable, you know, person. So when his fellow servants saw what had been done, they were very grieved. They came and told their master all that had been done. And the master, when he heard him, called him and said, "You wicked servant, I forgave you all that debt because you begged me. Shouldn't you have had compassion on your fellow servant just as I had pity on you?" His master was angry and delivered him to the torturers until he should pay all that was due to him. My heavenly Father will also do the same to each of you if you from your heart do not forgive your brother his trespasses. There's a message there. How will we treat our brothers and sisters? I mentioned at the beginning the business about being salt and light. To be a light to all who are in the house. How do we treat our fellow Christians, those who are in God's house with us? The other parable that deals with that too is Matthew 25, verses 31 to 46, the parable of the sheep and the goats. Also familiar, I'm sure. What's the point? What's the point of the parable of the sheep and the goats? Well, look at it in Matthew 25. The righteous are first of all amazed at what they're being given. In verse 37, Christ has told them, "I was hungry, you gave me food." Verse 35, "I was thirsty, you gave me drink. I was a stranger, you took me in. I was naked, and you clothed me. Sick, and you visited me. I was in prison, you came to me." That's why he said, "Inherit the kingdom prepared for you," in verse 34. They said, "We don't remember that. Thank you, but we don't remember doing that. When did we see you a stranger and take you in? Hungry and feed you, thirsty, give you drink, naked and clothe you. When did we see you sick or in prison and come to you?" The king will answer, verse 40, and say, "Assuredly I say to you, inasmuch as you did it to one of the least of these my brethren, you did it to me. I took it personally," he said. Of course, the sad part is that those on the other side had the same expression, the same answer. "We don't remember ever not doing that for you." And of course, the answer was similar. "Well, you didn't do it when you had the chance for my brethren. And I took that personally too." Tragically, the same point was made on the flip side. The message for God's people, brethren, is that he always sees. And he always knows and he always comprehends just who has really internalized this way of life, this calling, this mind of Jesus Christ. I've said it before and I'll say it again. Just when we think nobody knows or nobody sees, just remember, only God the Father and Jesus Christ and the 24 elders and billions of angels. But other than that, nobody knows what you're doing. It's a secret. We have to remember that. Along those lines, I'd like to close with something that I've already given in a recent message in both Cleveland and Meadville. So now I'll start all over and give that whole sermon. I will not do that. Because it really seems to tie in here. Underlying all these lessons from the royal majesty has been one bedrock truth. That's in Matthew 24:13. Matthew 24:13 says, "He who endures to the end shall be saved." Could it be any plainer than that? On the day that we think of the return of Jesus Christ and the resurrection of the saints. Not quite a year ago, Mr. Franks wrote a member letter in November of 2018 urging us all to avoid slipping into a complacent approach to our calling. He cited Hebrews 5 and verse 11, a critically important verse to grasp. Hebrews 5 and verse 11 reads this way. "Of whom," speaking of Jesus Christ as the high priest according to Melchizedek, "of whom we have much to say and hard to explain, since you have become dull of hearing." He cited that verse in that letter from nearly a year ago. And here's where I'd like to repeat from an earlier sermon that I gave not so long ago. So to paraphrase what they would say in the entertainment industry, previously from this pulpit, you heard, That's only if you were in Cleveland or Meadville, of course. You heard Hebrews 5:11, and being dull of hearing. Where does it go after these words? That's what was intriguing. Because then verses 12, 13, and 14 really got my attention, and I think they tie into us today. Though by this time you ought to be teachers. Brethren, some of us have been here for decades. I said if we could go around the room and find out how many feasts of trumpets have been kept in this group of 210 people, I know it would be in the multiple thousands. Multiple thousands. All we would need is an average of 20 years apiece to be about 4,000. And I'm sure there's probably more than an average of 20 apiece. You need someone, it says, to teach you again the first principles of the oracles of God. That matches the observation in verse 11 that you've become dull of hearing. You've come to need milk and not solid food, for everyone who partakes only of milk is unskilled in the word of righteousness. He's a babe. Solid food belongs to those who are of full age, mature. That is, those who by reason of use, practice, have their senses exercised to discern good and evil. But here's what got my attention. It struck me as I was reading those words and putting together that sermon that I might have been missing something, a kind of a connection or a deeper understanding. I asked you at the beginning of the message today, are God's holy days connected? Well, let's ask it with these verses. Are these verses connected? And I asked myself, does one condition lead to the other? In other words, were these people always immature spiritually? Or did they become that way because they became dull of hearing or complacent? Mr. Franks put that concept of complacency in my mind when I reread that letter. I recalled the phrase that he used, and I went back searching for it. That's the beauty of, you know, Google and search engines. I've frequently gone to Hebrews 5, verses 12, 13, and 14 to warn us about the danger of spiritual immaturity, where we see so clearly explained what it takes to be spiritually mature, what we need to do and what we need to be. But what if these people were once spiritually mature and then regressed to a less mature condition spiritually? If they did, what caused it? Because we need to know so that we don't repeat the process. The key phrase, essentially it's used twice, that grabbed my attention was used once in verse 11 and once in verse 12, which made me connect them. Verse 11 says, "You have become dull of hearing." And verse 12 says, "You have come to need milk." That's the same grammatical tense. You once were in one condition and you became another way. You were one way, but then you have since become dull of hearing. What would be the conclusion? You once were sharp of hearing, right? And somehow you became dull. The second verse, verse 12, "You have come to need milk and not solid food." What does that tell you? There was a time when you could digest solid food spiritually. And you have come to a point where you need milk, and that's all you can process. It was a progression or a regression. That's what made me think. It would seem that that is the real danger. The longer that Jesus Christ does not return, according to Matthew 24 and Matthew 25 and Matthew 13 and Matthew 18 and all those places we looked at today, there is a danger of complacency. Matthew 24, 13 says, "He who endures to the end shall be saved." Complacency, according to the way I'm now reading Hebrews 5, because it seems so clear, can lead to losing maturity spiritually. You're not as adept as you once were. You're not as fast on the pickup as you once were. You don't immediately connect. And I'm not talking about the way, as we get older, our minds search for things a little bit more often. What's your name? Oh, that's my wife. I should know who she is. But I'm talking about a spiritual recognition. Complacency can lead to losing maturity spiritually and regressing to a dangerously shallow spiritual condition. Brethren, we can't risk that. This day will come. He didn't return this year either. And we keep saying, how long, eternal? How long? But one day, the sun will rise, and before it sets, you and I will have set foot on the Mount of Olives too. We've done it once. Several of us who are here, it's an astonishing feeling. We were standing there on the day before the Feast of Pentecost. We were in Jerusalem on Pentecost, the anniversary of the giving of God's Spirit on Pentecost in Jerusalem. What about the future? Be aware of that when you leave here, please. Where the problems are on I-77. Oh, it can happen to us all. I patted my pocket immediately. I was like, wait, where's my... Brethren, you and I have an amazing calling. By this standard, we need to be sure that we are wide awake spiritually. It doesn't matter how long we've been doing this. The holy days, as they come every year, lead to a feeling of excitement and joy and anticipation. Gary Summers said it so well. He said, 3 weeks from today, it'll all be over. We wanted to throw rotten fruit at him for reminding us of that sad fact, because we sat here saying, that's bad. But the fact that we know what it means, that's good. Thank you, Mr. Myers. We will be saying that until Christ does come back. And we'll say, that's good. Brethren, are we spiritually wide awake? Are we aware of the dangers of becoming complacent? You and I are the only ones who can answer that. So now we've come to the point where I assign your homework for after the service. Here's your homework assignment from this message. Go back over every one of the parables we've read today and crank in the message from that nearly year-old letter to which I referred, the business about becoming dull of hearing or complacent. Factor into each parable the difference between being alert spiritually or drowsy spiritually. Complacent or active? And think of the marvelous meaning of this day. After all, according to Galatians 6 and verse 9, we're told, if we do not lose heart, we will reap. We will harvest. Verse 9 of Galatians 6, let us not grow weary while doing good, for in due season we shall reap if we do not lose heart. Read James 5 for the stress on the qualities of patience that God has as we wait for his son to return. Those are the qualities of God that we are counting on. He will not let his precious children down. Let's be sure that he can say the same about us. Wait patiently for him and have a marvelous fall holy day season of rejoicing before our loving Father.